A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The strangest part is the Google notification. You're sitting there, 3 days after firing off an email you dictated while making coffee, and your phone buzzes to tell you your own words are now in a newspaper.
And you read them like they belong to someone else.
Daniel wrote to Greer Faye Cashman at the Jerusalem Post, responding to her grapevine column about how construction chaos is making Jerusalem impossible for elderly residents to navigate. His point was that it's not just the elderly. He's in his 30s with a 14-month-old son, no mobility issues, and the same block sidewalks and diverted bus stops are hammering him too.
Which is a fair point. Accessibility problems don't only hit people with walkers. Try pushing a stroller through the current state of Jaffa Road.
He dictated the email in about 3 minutes, sent it as a short personal note. Then the column ran, quoted him in full, and he read it and thought, I could have said that better. His words, his phrasing, his regret. So his question for us is the whole landscape of giving quotes to journalists. Best practices for being on the record, whether recording calls as a source, is actually useful. What to do when you're misquoted without torching the relationship, and whether journalists deserve grace when they're operating under deadline pressure. Plus the do's and don'ts, whether this is part of your job or a personal mission.
He's got the background to ask this from a weird position. He interned at an Irish newspaper in New York, freelanced for them for years, used to carry a tape recorder to every interview. He's been on both sides of the notebook.
So this is really about the gap between what we mean and what gets printed, and why that gap exists even when nobody's acting in bad faith. Let's dig in.
The first thing to understand is that the journalist controls the edit. That's the entire asymmetry. You hand over your words, and then they decide what survives, what gets trimmed, what sits next to what, and what headline frames the whole thing. You don't get a preview. You don't get a veto.
Daniel's case is almost the purest version of that. He wrote a casual email, not a prepared statement. It read like correspondence because it was correspondence. Then it became a published quote, and suddenly the conversational looseness he'd have revised in a typed letter was permanent.
And there's the dictation layer. He dictated the email. Dictation produces spoken language, not written language. More clauses, more filler, more sentences that trail off or loop back. When you type, you compress. When you dictate, you ramble, and the rambling reads fine in your head because you can hear your own intonation. In print, the intonation's gone and the words just sit there.
So what he's regretting isn't necessarily that the journalist misrepresented him. It's that his own phrasing, produced in a hurry through a medium that makes everyone sound more casual than they intend, became public.
Right? And that's the first misconception worth killing. Most quote distortion isn't malicious. It's structural. Deadlines, word counts, the need for a quote to fit a narrative arc. A journalist on a Tuesday afternoon has 40 minutes to file, and your three paragraphs need to become one sentence that lands a point. That compression is where things get bent.
I think people imagine the reporter sitting there twisting words deliberately. The reality is more boring. They're cutting for space. They're pulling the sentence that most cleanly advances the story, and the sentence that most cleanly advances the story is rarely the one you'd have chosen as your finest moment.
And Daniel knows this from the other side. He's been the one transcribing a tape at 2 a.m, trying to find the quote that carries the piece. The source said 40 things. 3 of them were sharp. The sharp ones weren't necessarily the most representative of the source's overall position, but they were the ones that made the story work.
That's the uncomfortable part. The journalist's job isn't to make you look good. It's to produce a readable piece on deadline. Those two goals overlap sometimes, but not always.
Let's talk about off the record, because Daniel raised it and it's a trap.
The phrase everyone thinks protects them.
The phrase that protects almost no one. Off the record has no universal definition. It means different things to different journalists, different publications, different countries. Some reporters treat it as, I won't name you, but I can use the information. Others treat it as, I can't use this at all unless I confirm it elsewhere. And the confirmation elsewhere is the part sources forget. You tell a journalist friend something off the record, he can't print it, but he can now go ask someone else about it with the advantage of knowing what to look for.
And the journalist friend problem is real. You're at dinner, you say. Off the record, the real reason the project stalled is that the contractor never got the permits. Your friend nods. 3 weeks later, a story runs about the permit failure, sourced to someone else. You didn't get burned directly, but your off-the-record remark became the map.
The only version of off-the-record that actually works is one where you've agreed, explicitly, in advance, what the terms are, and you trust the person to honor them. And even then, if the information is good enough, the pressure to use it's enormous.
Daniel's suggestion about recording calls is the more practical protection. Sources can record. The legal landscape in most places allows it if you're a party to the conversation, though some jurisdictions require both party consent. Israel's generally permissive on this for participants. But the legal part matters less than the behavioral part.
The behavioral part is that saying, I'm recording this for accuracy, changes the dynamic instantly. The journalist knows there's a check on their transcription. They know their own questions are being captured. It professionalizes the conversation. And a reporter who's acting in good faith won't blink at it because they're probably recording too.
Daniel used to bring a tape recorder to every interview. The reporter's recorder is a tool of accuracy. The source's recorder is the same tool pointed the other direction. It's not aggressive. It's symmetrical.
And the misconception that it's hostile comes from an older era when recording was rare and the request sounded like you were preparing for litigation. Now everyone has a phone that records. The stigma's mostly gone. The practical advice is to say it plainly. I'm going to record this so I can refer back to what I actually said. No apology, no explanation beyond that.
Which brings us to the harder question. When the quote comes out wrong, or when you regret it, what do you actually do?
First, distinguish between two completely different problems. One is, I was misquoted. The words attributed to me are what I said, or they're stripped of the context that made them mean what I meant. The other is, I said that, and I wish I'd said it better. Daniel's Jerusalem Post quote is the second one. His earlier phone interview in Israel, where words were taken out of context, is the first.
And conflating the two is how you burn bridges fast. If you email a journalist demanding a correction because you don't love your own phrasing, you've just told them their accurate reporting is the problem. The next time you reach out, they're going to remember that.
The correction ladder starts with letting it go. If it's minor, if it's a slightly awkward sentence, if you're the only person who noticed, the correct response is silence. Your regret isn't a journalistic failure.
The second rung is a private, respectful clarification, not a demand. A note that says, for the record, my actual position is more nuanced than the quote suggests. Can we talk about it? This preserves the relationship and gives the journalist information they might use later.
The third rung is a correction request, and it's only for factual errors. The date was wrong, the number was wrong, the attribution was wrong. Publications have processes for this, and they're more responsive when you're specific and calm.
And the fourth rung, public pushback, is reserved for genuine misrepresentation that does real damage. Not annoyance. Damage. If you're gonna go public, you better be right, because you're now in a fight with someone who owns a platform.
Daniel's instinct about giving journalists grace is the right one. And it's not just politeness, it's strategy. The journalist who misquoted you today is the journalist who might cover your issue tomorrow. If you respond with fury, you've lost that channel. If you respond with a measured note, you've gained a contact who now owes you slightly.
And most misquotes are genuine mistakes. Deadline pressure, editing layers, a transcription error, a sentence pulled from one context and dropped into another. The reporter isn't your enemy. They're a tired person trying to file.
I saw this in medicine, honestly. Patients would come in furious about something a nurse had said, and 9 times out of 10, it was a communication failure, not malice. The nurse was rushed, the patient was anxious, the phrasing was ambiguous. Journalism's the same. The quote got mangled because the system is designed for speed, not precision.
Prevention is the real answer, and it's less work than damage control. Treat every interaction with a journalist as on the record, even the casual ones. Prepare talking points even for emails. And when the stakes matter, type. Don't dictate.
The typing point is underrated. Written language and spoken language are different registers. Daniel's quote suffered from the dictation gap. If he'd typed the same email, he'd have compressed it, edited it, caught the loose phrasing. Dictation is fine for internal notes. For anything that might be quoted, slow down and write.
And there's the power dynamic. Sources need journalists because they want the platform. Journalists need sources because they can't write stories without them. It's mutual dependency, an understanding that changes how you negotiate. You're not a supplicant, you're a counterparty.
When it's part of your job, you probably have training or a communications team. Corporate environments have processes for this. When it's a personal mission, like Daniel's accessibility point, you're on your own, and the risks are different. No safety net, no review, no one to catch the awkward sentence before it goes out.
Daniel's case is interesting because his personal mission overlapped with his professional identity. He's a tech communicator by trade. He knows how to write. But he dictated a casual email, and the casual email became the quote. The lesson isn't that he's bad at this. It's that the medium shapes the message, and casual mediums produce casual messages.
The other thing about the Grapevine column specifically is that it's a human interest format. Greer Faye Cashman's column runs in Google News feeds, it's widely read, and it has a particular tone. It's not hard news, it's community observation. So a reader's email fits the format perfectly, and the bar for what gets quoted is lower than it'd be for a news story.
Which is why Daniel got quoted in full. He sent a personal note that matched the column's register, and it ran. The surprise was the publication, not the content.
Let me ask you something, Korn. You've been quoted. What did you do the first time you saw your own words in print and cringed?
I cringed privately and told myself the next one would be tighter. The cringe is universal. Everyone sounds worse to themselves in print because you're hearing the sentence without the warmth, without the context, without the person you were when you said it.
That's the gap Daniel's really describing. The gap between the person you're in conversation and the person you become when your words are frozen and displayed.
And the gap isn't fixable. You can narrow it with preparation, with typing, with shorter sentences, with knowing your talking points. But you can't eliminate it. The moment your words leave your mouth or your email leaves your outbox, they're not yours anymore.
The correction ladder, though. Let's make it concrete. Step 1, let it go. Step 2, private clarification. Step 3, correction request for factual errors only. Step 4, public pushback for genuine damage. And the grace principle sits underneath all of it. Assume good faith until proven otherwise.
The other thing about grace is that it's not just for the journalist's benefit. It's for yours. Anger in the moment feels righteous, but it produces bad decisions. You fire off the furious email, the journalist screenshots it, and now your fury is part of the story. The measured note preserves your options.
And the measured note is more effective. Journalists respond to professionalism because they're drowning in unprofessionalism. The source who writes a calm, specific correction request is the source they'll actually help. The source who writes in all caps goes to the bottom of the pile.
Daniel's earlier experience with the phone interview is the cautionary tale for the other side. Words taken out of context. That's a genuine journalistic failure, and it's the one that justifies real pushback. But even then, the first move is private.
The context problem is everywhere. You say, I support the project in principle, but the implementation has been a disaster. The quote runs as, the implementation has been a disaster. The first half, the qualifying half, gets cut for space or because it doesn't fit the angle. You're not misquoted, you're decontextualized.
Which is worse, in some ways, because the words are accurate and the meaning is wrong. Fighting, that's harder. The correction request has to be, the quote is accurate, but the context changes the meaning, and here's the full statement. Whether the journalist fixes it depends on the publication and the stakes.
Recording the call protects you here. If you have the tape, you can prove what you actually said. But the better protection is to front-load your qualification. Don't bury the caveat in the middle of a long answer. Put it first. I support the project, but the implementation has been a disaster. That way, even if the second half gets pulled, the first half is harder to ignore.
That's a talking points discipline. Know your one-sentence position, know your one-line caveat, and lead with both. It's not about scripting yourself, it's about making your key points hard to cut.
And for email, the discipline is even simpler. Write the email, read it, Ask yourself, if this ran in full tomorrow, would I be okay with it? If the answer is no, revise. Daniel skipped that step because he was dictating and moving fast.
The 3-minute email is the enemy. Anything that takes 3 minutes to produce can take 3 years to live down.
Or at least 3 weeks of Googling yourself.
So we know how distortion happens. The harder question is, what you do when it happens to you without torching the relationship?
The relationship is the asset. That's the thing people forget in the moment. You're not just correcting a quote. You're managing a connection with someone who controls access to a platform. If you torch the connection, you've won the argument and lost the war.
And the war matters more if you're doing this for a personal mission. Daniel's accessibility point is something he cares about beyond one email. If he'd responded to the quote with fury, he'd have lost the ability to ever raise the issue with that columnist again. The measured response preserves the channel.
The grace framework Daniel suggested isn't soft, it's strategic. You give the journalist the benefit of the doubt because it's usually deserved and because it keeps the door open. You escalate only when the evidence says the failure was deliberate or the damage is severe.
The escalation ladder is really a filtering system. Most problems die at step one. A few reach step two. Almost none should reach step four.
And step four, when you do go public, changes the game. You're now a story, not a source. The journalist's publication will defend them because publications defend their people. You'd better have receipts, and you'd better be ready for the fight to be the story.
The other thing worth saying is that being quoted is often the goal. You want the platform. You want the issue covered. The quote is the price of admission. So the question isn't how to avoid being quoted. It's how to be quoted well.
Preparation. Typed, not dictated. Short sentences. Lead with your main point. Assume everything's on the record. Record the call. Review your own words before they go out. And when the quote runs, accept that you'll always find something to regret.
The regret is the cost of participation. Everyone who's ever been quoted has read their own words and winced. The people who do it well aren't the ones who never wince. They're the ones who winced, learned, and tightened up for the next time.
Let me throw in the other angle. What about when the journalist is the one who screwed up and they know it? The good ones will fix it if you make it easy for them. The correction request that says, "I think there may have been a transcription issue, here's what I actually said," gives them a face-saving way to run a correction. The request that says, "Your reporter is incompetent," gets you nothing.
Face-saving is underrated. People will do a lot to avoid being publicly wrong. Give them a private, specific, non-accusatory path to fix the error, and most will take it.
And if they don't, you've learned something about the publication. That's information too. The correction request is a test of the relationship. The response tells you whether this is a journalist worth working with again.
Daniel's dual perspective is the interesting wrinkle. He's been the reporter transcribing tapes at Deadline. He knows the scramble. So his instinct toward grace isn't just politeness. It's empathy born of experience. He's made the same mistakes he's now asking us about.
And the mistakes are structural, not personal. That's the point worth repeating. The journalist who misquotes you at Deadline isn't usually incompetent or malicious. They're a person doing a hard job fast, and your quote was one of 40 things they had to get right that day.
The misquote rate would drop if journalists had more time, more editors, more budget. But they don't. So the source's job is to make their own words hard to mangle.
Short sentences. Clear position. The caveat up front. The recording running. The email typed and reviewed. That's the entire toolkit, honestly.
The emotional toolkit is just as important. Detach from the quote once it's out. It's not you. It's a snapshot of you at a moment, filtered through someone else's process. The snapshot can be flattering or not, but it's never the whole picture.
The people who do this professionally understand that. They don't read their quotes with pride or shame. They read them as data. Did the message land? Did the key point survive? If yes, the awkward sentence doesn't matter. If no, adjust for next time.
The key point is the test. Daniel's key point was that accessibility problems affect young parents too. That survived. The quote ran in full. The message landed. The phrasing he regrets is noise around a signal that came through clearly.
Which means his regret is mostly misplaced. He's cringing at the wording, but the substance worked. The column ran, his point was made, and the issue got airtime. That's a win dressed up as a failure.
That's worth saying directly. If you get quoted and your point survives, you won. The phrasing is a tax, not a loss.
The real losses are when the point gets inverted, when the context gets stripped, when you're made to say the opposite of what you meant. That's when the latter matters, and that's when you escalate.
The do's and don'ts. Do prepare. Do type. Do record. Do assume everything's on the record. Do lead with your main point. Do respond to problems with calm specificity. Don't dictate when the stakes matter. Don't treat off the record as a magic shield. Don't demand corrections for stylistic regret. Don't go public unless the damage is real.
Don't burn the bridge. The bridge is the whole game.
The bridge is the whole game. That's the line.
Let me add one thing about the personal mission angle, because Daniel raised it, and it's different from the job angle. When you're doing this for a cause, the emotional stakes are higher. You care more. And caring more makes the regret sharper and the anger hotter. The discipline is the same, but the difficulty is higher.
The safety net is thinner. No comms team, no review process, no institutional memory. Just you and your email client and a 3-minute dictation session.
The advice doesn't change. It just matters more. The personal mission is exactly where you need to slow down, because there's no one else to catch the error.
Which is the real lesson of Daniel's experience. Not that he did something wrong, that he did something human, and the system amplified the human part.
The counselor's joke about selling the Civic Center to a parking lot company ran on the front page. He said it at the end of a 2-hour budget meeting, flat as a board, and I heard a story. This was in New Zealand, early 2000s. I was stringing for the local paper, covering council meetings, and the trick was you sat through 3 hours of drainage reports to get one usable quote. The counselor said, and I'm paraphrasing from the tape, well, if the rates don't cover it, we could always flog the Civic Center to a parking lot company. Dead silence. I wrote it down. It ran. He called the paper the next morning and said I'd made him look like a lunatic. I listened to the tape again at 2 in the morning, and I still couldn't tell if he was joking. The tone was flat. The room was tired. He might have been serious. He might have been floating a trial balloon and letting me carry it. I never found out. The paper ran a clarification saying the remark was made in jest because the counselor insisted it was, but I've still got the tape, and I still don't know.
The trial balloon possibility is the uncomfortable part. He gets to say whatever he wants, and if it lands badly, he blames you for not catching the joke.
That's the thing about being the one with the recorder. People say things to you they wouldn't say to a room full of voters, and they know you're recording. They just forget.
The flat tone is the whole problem. In print, everything's flat. The joke and the series proposal look identical.
That's why I always told sources to put the important thing in writing, not because I was going to screw them, because the tape doesn't catch the wink.
You were the guy with the tape recorder Daniel used to be. Same job, different hemisphere.
It's the same job everywhere. You sit there, you listen, you try to find the sentence that carries the story, and sometimes you pick the wrong sentence, and the person who said it has to live with it.
Did the counselor ever speak to you again?
He did, actually. A week later, at another meeting, he came over and said no hard feelings. Then he told me, off the record, that he'd been serious about the parking lot idea, but didn't want his name attached. So the clarification was the lie, and the front page was the truth. That's the part that still bothers me.
You were right the first time.
I was right, and I apologized for it. That's journalism for you.
That story raises something. Hilbert heard what he wanted to hear. But maybe the counselor wanted him to hear it. Where does that leave the rest of us?
It leaves us with the same asymmetry we started with. The source speaks, the journalist filters, and the truth is somewhere in the gap. Sometimes the filter helps you, sometimes it hurts you, and sometimes you don't know which until years later.
The open question, then. We're all potential sources now. Newsletters, blogs, social posts, a columnist's inbox. The barrier between private correspondence and public quote is thinner than it's ever been. Does that change the calculus, or just make the old rules more urgent?
I think it makes the old rules more urgent. The tools are the same. Preparation, precision, the assumption that anything you write might be printed. What's changed is the volume. More people are getting quoted, more casually, with less awareness of the stakes.
The uncomfortable truth is that Daniel's quote wasn't ruined by a journalist. It was ruined by the gap between casual speech and permanent text. That gap is a feature of being human in a world where everything you say can be captured, forwarded, and published.
The goal isn't to never regret a quote. That's impossible. The goal is to minimize the damage when you do, and to save your outrage for actual misrepresentation.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the story about the counselor who maybe wasn't joking.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want to reach us, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.